I'm Lauren, and I'm the teacher today. And I'm going to begin with a poem. And the poem I'm going to begin with is a poem that I think goes with patience and my talk today. It's called The Gladdest Thing by Jensei, who was a 17th century literary monk. And I chose it because I thought it would set a patient, maybe even aimless tone, in contrast with our pretty prevalent goal-oriented can't wait world that we live in. So I think I'll even ring the bell once to get us focused. And now I'll start with the poem. The Gladdest Thing, Poem Without a Category, by Jensei, a 17th century literary monk. Trailing my stick, I go down to the garden edge, call to a monk to go out the pine gate. A cup of tea with my mother, looking at each other, enjoying our tea together. In the deep lanes, few people in sight. The dog barks when anyone comes or goes. Fall floods have washed away the planks of the bridge. Shouldering our sandals, we wade the narrow stream. By the roadside, a small pavilion, where there used to be a little hill. It helps out our hermit mood. Country poems pile one sheet on another. I dabble in the flow, delighted by the shallowness of the stream. Gaze at the flagging, admiring how firm the stones are. The point in life is to know what's enough. Why envy those otherworld immortals? With a happiness held in 1-inch square heart, you can fill the whole space between heaven and earth. So I'll tell you the schedule. I'll do a talk now. We've been focusing on the paramis this year. And each month we start a new parami. And the parami, which is one of the qualities that the Buddha had that we try to emulate and cultivate. And one we're focusing on is patience. And that's what the talk will be on. Okay. So, I've already said that I'm talking on patience, and we've had two other talks on patience so far, maybe three. So, I have found this parami challenging and also very rewarding, and I've had a hard time pinning it down. It seems to take on different qualities depending on what I'm trying to be patient with. The words most often used to define patience are tolerance and perseverance without reactivity. When we are patient, we can accept less than perfect conditions like delays, trouble, discomfort. And we've been investigating both patience and impatience. For example, when I'm in a hurry and the person in front of me is walking very slowly, I hear a voice in my head sometimes saying, "Get out of my way." And I'm shocked by my intolerance. The person may have a very good reason for moving slowly. They may be a woman or man who's quite a bit older, which doesn't happen too often anymore. used to a lot, or they might have an injury or disability. Other times I can be impatient with myself and feel disappointment or shame when I don't think I have performed well enough or behaved as I should. Sometimes fear underlies my impatience. This can happen when I encounter people who have views and opinions of the way things should be that are different from mine. Irritation can change to fear when I judge that the stakes are high, and then my impatience can take on an urgency and cause anxiety. When we cultivate the parami of patience, we're growing our ability to relax with the way things are right now. We can wait. Even when there is stress or suffering, we can trust in the wisdom available to us in the moment and allow things to unfold. Right now, I'm thinking of an example of this kind of situation that I read about in Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Fragrant Palm Leaves. And I don't remember the details specifically, but I'm going to try to recount it as best I can. So this was during the end of the Vietnam War, and Thich Nhat Hanh and his fellow peace activists were trying to save some boat people from being attacked by pirates. It seemed that they had exhausted all options of negotiating refuge for the refugees, and the boat people were going to be forced out of a safe harbor into the open sea the next morning. And what were Thich Nhat Hanh and the other activists doing at this critical moment? They were meditating. He said they had deepened their intention to be mindful during this period of time when they were trying to rescue these boat people. And they were just meditating every moment they could. So it was the night before they were going to be forced out, the boat people. And they decided this was the most effective thing they could do at this time, was just to meditate. So sometime during the early hours of the morning, an answer came to Thich Nhat Hanh, and it just popped into his mind that he would contact the French ambassador. And he did that in the morning, or at that moment, I can't remember. And the boat people were granted the protection they needed to save their lives. I was impressed by this story of Thich Nhat Hanh. When faced with such a dire situation, he persevered, he and the other activists, without reacting by wasting energy on anger, blame, fear, or overwhelm. He and the other activists had lost control of the outer conditions, so they worked with the only thing they did have control of, and that was their mind. This focus on our own minds is an important point to make. And I'm going to quote a few teachers who do make a point about this. And the first one is Mathieu Ricard, who's a French geneticist who became a Tibetan monk. Some of you may have heard of him. He's been in the news. I think they do a lot of experiments on his brain for seeing what the effects of meditation are. He's also a translator for the Dalai Lama. So this is what he says. He says, "We want the world to allow the unconditional fulfillment of all our aspirations. And since this does not happen, we fall prey to suffering. Our search for happiness is more often founded in our illusions than on reality. It is pointless to try to shape the world to fit our desires. We must transform our minds." Ajahn Suchito, who we quote a lot and has written the book on the paramis that we've been using, says, "We can try to adjust outer conditions to suit us, but it is a never-ending process and we have to keep adjusting. The wise person focuses on adjusting the mind instead." And the third person, Pema Chodron, says, "The key is in changing our habits, and in particular, the habits of our mind." We're living in troubled times. I think it's safe to say that a lot of us are feeling that things are spinning out of control. It's hard to listen, to watch, or read about current events. There's polarization over what we should do to make the world right again. During our Sunday sit discussion last week, some of us started to discuss the situation in light of the parami of patience. I decided to continue that investigation in my talk today. How do we frame this challenge in light of the Dharma and the parami of patience? I'm thinking about the floods that Ajahn Sucitto described in his book, Parami: Ways to Cross Life's Floods. Specifically, I'm looking at the floods of becoming and views. The floods are the worldly currents of samsara that push us in a direction which is away from freedom and awakening. Ajahn Sucitto says that the Buddha encourages us to see these floods as phenomena without attributing self, other, culture, or religion to them. He says, when we develop the paramis, we are building a temple from whose vantage point, I'm sorry, when I say he says, it's actually Ajahn Sucitto who says this, not the Buddha. Ajahn Sucitto says that when we develop the paramis, we're building a temple from whose vantage point we can investigate the floods. With the parami of patience, we loosen our grip on our views and cultivate tolerance for the views of others who have different, even opposing views. With the parami of patience, we cultivate perseverance over time toward our aspiration for freedom and awakening for ourselves and all beings. We weigh the value of what is worth our perseverance and what can be let go of. Understanding the floods of becoming and views offers insights from the vantage point of patience. The flood of becoming exerts pressure on us with respect to time expectations and identity expectations. Our society conditions us to assume that more and faster is better. Having something concrete to show for one's efforts is usually the requirement. Good enough is not good enough. Perfection is the goal. In contrast, when we cultivate the parami of patience, we're asked to connect with and accept the reality of, but not approve of necessarily, the way things are, no matter what their degree of perfection. We have to accept the imperfection in ourselves and others and in our world so we can tolerate the dukkha long enough to penetrate and understand it. Then it won't rule us and it won't identify, and we won't identify it as us or them. It will just be that dukkha and that stress, that problem or that imperfection. When we accept the reality of the way things are, we are not giving up on our aspiration to hold with right view and right intention, to not cause harm to ourselves or others. We can still persevere with our values. I've always loved the story of Angulimala in the suttas, and I know I've shared this sutta before, but I'm going to share it in this context again. You can hear stories over and over, I think. Angulimala was the opposite of perfect. He was a famous murderer who was terrorizing the countryside. Angulimala means finger necklace in Pali, and he was called this because he wore the necklace of the fingers of his victims around his neck. The story goes that the Buddha was visiting the area where Angulimala was terrorizing everyone, and despite being warned by the locals not to go out alone in the forest, the Buddha went out and met up with Angulimala, who, when he saw the Buddha, immediately drew his sword and started chasing after him. He intended to make the Buddha his next victim. But although Angulimala was running as fast as he could not catch up with the Buddha, who was walking calmly at an even pace. Angulimala was bewildered and called to the Buddha to stop. The Buddha replied calmly, "I have already stopped. It is you, Angulimala, who must stop." The subtext, in other words, is I, Buddha, am standing still, having for all beings laid down the rod. But you, Angulimala, are unrestrained regarding creatures. Therefore, it is you who must stop. In the story, Angulimala is impressed by the courage of the Buddha and struck with guilt for what he has done. This is an example of the Buddha's perfection of the parami of patience. He shows tolerance and equanimity toward Angulimala, even when Angulimala is intending to kill him. He perseveres with the aspiration to help all beings and freedom, to find freedom and awaken, including this murderer. His non-harming response to Angulimala causes Angulimala to vow to stop his murdering and follow the Buddha as a monk. This is an example of how the Buddha responded to Angulimala with tolerance and at the same time was able to respond in an appropriate way, a way that stopped Angulimala from continuing to cause harm to himself and others. It's tricky and it's a high bar the Buddha has set for us, but this is the direction the Buddha is pointing us toward. We get pushed around by the flood of views. It seems to be closely related to the flood of becoming. We have views about the way things should be, we should be, and others should be. Clinging to these shoulds solidifies the self and forms part of our identity. How we try to make them happen in time is a source of stress when we're not patient. Clinging to views and opinions isolates us and inflates the ego, and we have a great opportunity to investigate the dukkha caused by views and becoming right now because of the polarization and proliferation of opinions in the media and in our world. I saw for myself how deeply I was prejudiced by some of my opinions recently when I read about a person who I would normally judge very harshly based on their political affiliation. And when I read the article about this person, my unkindness came face to face with the person's humanity. I felt the ugliness of that hatred I was cultivating toward a group of people. I realized this is a serious problem. It's a dilemma too, because I have a vision for the way people need to act to promote the well-being of all, and my views reflect that vision, and when I encounter people with views that seem to threaten that vision, I begin to see them as the enemy. This isn't right view, I know. In the conclusion of the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is the Buddha's words of loving kindness, he says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. I think the adjective fixed is what's important. We will all have differing views based on our differing experiences. Differing causes and conditions will lead us in differing directions with our views and actions. But if we let our views project onto others so that others become objectified and then we prejudge their humanity based on their view, we're in trouble. We have to see that views and opinions are relative. We have to have patience with others' views of the way things are and should be. But then there is the fear underneath our views. What if that other view becomes reality? What about the harm we believe may be caused by a view that has already become reality? I think this can be met with the parami of patience too. Not unlike the way Thich Nhat Hanh met the challenge with the boat people. When Tweri gave her talk on patience at the Monday night sit earlier this month, she talked about the six steps of insight dialogue developed by insight meditation teacher Gregory Kramer. And some of you are, I'm sure, familiar with these steps already. But for those of you who aren't, they are pause, think of them in terms of patience, pause, relax, open, trust emergence, listen deeply, speak the truth. They're the steps of a method of meditating with another person, and I practiced regularly with this method for about 10 years, And it is definitely a practice that involves the parami of patience. It taught me a lot about discovering wisdom patiently and respectfully with another person. I've also applied these steps in situations outside of insight dialogue. Pause as a first step in action has been really helpful. It gives the opportunity to be mindful of the moment, to embody an understanding that this is the way it is right now. That is so important to finding out what an appropriate action is. Before acting, pause. Second step, relax. Take a deep breath. This helps me respond instead of react and helps me release my mental agenda and any fight or flight emotional defenses I might have. Open to a perspective beyond me and you. Take in the wider, deeper, longer term view. Trust emergence taps into an intuitive whole body mind versus a logical thinking mind. And I think this is where insight comes in. Listen deeply to yourself and to the other. Ajahn Suchito talks often about the fact that wisdom comes from being receptive, to being quiet and listening. And the last step, speak the truth. This step can also be applied with an action when we act in a way that aligns with truth or reality. When we have been patient and persevering in a process like this, we have a better chance of taking appropriate action. Pause, relax, open, trust emergence, listen deeply, speak the truth, or take appropriate action. There are more patient ways to experience the world than what our society promotes, and sometimes just any one of those steps is helpful. I recently was reading in a book on the Heart Sutra by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's a Zen perspective. But in it, he talked about aimlessness. He said that aimlessness is the third of the three doors of liberation. This was the first time I had heard of aimlessness in the context of a Buddhist concept. He referred to it as a deep and wonderful teaching. It means, he said, not running after things, not putting an object in front of you and continually reaching for it. And he went on, some people chase enlightenment, but it is already there inside you. It can't be grasped by the mind. It can only be experienced by letting go. If we cannot stop running, we will miss the miracles of life available inside and around us. Aimlessness is a pretty radical concept in our time. I think of the to-do list that I make every morning, even though I'm retired and no one is telling me what I have to do. I believe there are things I have to do every day anyway, and it's scary for me to think of what might happen if I didn't put these goals in front of me and continually reach for them. Then I think of how fruitful it can be on retreat to experience a degree of aimlessness every day within the container of the retreat structure. Sit, walk, listen to a talk, eat, sleep, have an interview, repeat. It does nurture an experiencing of the miracles of life inside me and around me. And that is truly a deep and wonderful experience. Many teachers that we choose suggest that we choose a day a week or a day a month to pause our pace for a personal retreat, where we move very slowly and live within a simple set of activities. Thich Nhat Hanh in Miracle of Mindfulness says to set aside one day a week and forget the work you do during the other days. He offers a variety of suggestions and concludes with, every movement during this day should be at least 2 times slower than usual. I've thought about doing a personal retreat many times, but I've never made that time for it. I get very stressed out when I'm too busy, but I've still never made time for a personal retreat. The closest I've come has been to do a Zoom retreat, which provides a nice container with a schedule, a teacher, and a sangha, and I'm sure a lot of you have done that. But the hardest parts of those retreats for me is to let go of my personal to-dos during the unscheduled retreat time. It's very challenging to be aimless in our society. This helps me see how much I am attached to goals and results. I think it's the currents of the flood of becoming that are pushing me in this direction. I would like to cultivate more patience with just being and not becoming anything or producing anything. To clarify, I'm not saying that it would be good to lead a totally aimless, non-productive life. It's about balance and noticing when the habit is controlling me, when I can't slow down or let go of a to-do list, when I want to notice that. I want to say one more thing about patience with views. I recently attended a gathering online which was sponsored by some well-respected insight meditation teachers, and the purpose was political. We were asked to contribute to some organizations supporting a political party. The speakers were Dharma practitioners and activists who supported the same political party. Each of them spoke about the work they did and the values and objectives they believed their work supported. It was actually very inspiring for me to hear these people share who had views and intentions which were like my own. And it helped me feel not alone with my values and aspirations. I think there's a place for joining with people of like mind. It can help us be tolerant and less fearful, knowing that there are others who care and are doing what they can, just as we are, and doing what we can. Ajahn Suchito calls this resonance with one's own suffering and vulnerability, so we can resonate with another's self-suffering and vulnerability, and resonate with people who resonate with others' suffering and vulnerability. So, joining together with people whose values are compassionate action, without blaming others or separating themselves or, separating. In a talk that Ajahn Suchita gave called Training the Chitta is Your Best Bet, calls it resonance, compassionate, not connecting with other people based on an ideology, because there's no blame or righteousness. And we're not, we're aware of views, but we're not identifying with views. And he says there's a subtle difference, and that is that when we identify with views, we're saying, I am this, you are that this. But when you're saying that is that, you're aware of the view, but you're not identifying with it, and that's mindfulness or awareness. So he said that, we connect on things we have in common, but it's a heart thing. It's not an ideological conception thing. And so there is a perseverance. This is where perseverance comes in. Even when we're uncertain about the success of what we do, its results, we can stick to it if it's right view and right intention. And so I'm closing with the poem that many of you have heard. I've read it before, and we read it. It was read at our celebration of opening our space. And it's called The Way It Is, William Stafford. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer, and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. So, that's what I have to say about patience, tolerance, and perseverance. Letting go and holding on. And so at this point, we are going to go in to breakout groups and to discuss patience, tolerance, perseverance, the world situation, your own practice. I want to remind you that this is an opportunity to listen and reflect. We don't offer advice. Everyone gets a chance to speak. And we keep everything confidential so that the space is safe for everyone. And the prompt would be, thinking of patience as tolerance and perseverance. What do you aspire to with patience? What obstacles do you run into with tolerance and perseverance? And what successes have you had? See if everybody's back. Not quite. There we go. This is a time if anyone would like to share with the larger group anything that you discussed in the small group or any other comments or questions. Judith?
Yeah, it really struck me at the end of our conversation how valuable it is to be able to share with each other our various views on impatience. And I've been experiencing a lot of anger and impatience toward the political chaos, right? And I know I'm not alone in that respect. And finding it difficult, I mean, I'm very aware of it. How it feels doesn't feel good, and feeling also very intolerant, all of these things that you mentioned, and just being able to talk to everybody and suddenly remember, oh yeah, this is not permanent. This is passing. This is going to go away. The situation's going to go away. My anger's going to go away. It's all actually... It just is. It is what it is. Yeah. But when I'm here, you know, stewing about it by myself, it makes it, I can see it. It's not that I can't see it, but it makes it harder to get past it, I think.
Yeah, I think that connecting with people who can hear and you can dialogue with is really, really important. In this, with the views, but connecting in a way that's wholesome and, you know, productive and is like, helps you beat more, your heart, you know, opening your heart, not being right, furthering the righteousness. But if we have common, compassionate goals that are wholesome, it really helps to know there's others. We're not alone. And, yeah. We can hear each other and yeah. So thank you for sharing that, Judith and Jerry. You need to unmute.
I guess following on that, yeah, it's very supportive. You know, we gather in Sangha this morning and we kind of have shared ideas and we feel all supported. It's the other. The work for me is with the other, all the others that I don't share common views, you know, and how am I patient when I run into, a sibling, for example, with different views. So that's where my challenge is.
Yeah, this
to be supported and reinforced. Oh, yeah, you're right, you're right, you're right. Yeah, we can do that amongst ourselves, but it's nice to be challenged. And discomfort can be an opening to growth, I guess.
Exactly. We have this wonderful opportunity, as challenging as it is right now. Anyone else want to share anything? We have a little more time. Oh, Julie.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about how this dichotomy between our tendency as humans to put labels on things kind of can get in the way and narrow our minds and our focus and make us less tolerant, and how, you know, the practice of just trying to open up and be a little bit aware of, you know, the impermanence, of course, and just the ever changing, you know, it's just kind of who we are, I guess, as humans. You know, we want to latch on to stuff and we want to paste labels on them. And, you know, in the end, you know, of course, we all just want to not suffer, right? We just have different ideas about what that means. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it's good to remember that labeling. And then that, of course, puts us in the camps and solidifies us and makes them. And yeah, but it's good to remember that. So thank you, Julie, for bringing that up. Jean, did you still want to share something?
I did. I just think the value of Sangha is incalculable, and we can't put a price on it. It's so easy. It's so difficult to stay with an idea by yourself, but in Sangha, where people treat it as sacred space and you come as you are and I come as I am, then we can share that. And how many times have I had the sharp burrs or edges of my thinking softened and rounded by being in presence of Sangha? It's a kind of unfortunate that I don't have some sort of simplistic way to do it all by myself, but I'm grateful for the Sangha because that's what you helped me do. And it's priceless. It's a thing of great beauty. Thank you.
Suze?
Just to follow up on that, somebody in my small group reminded us at the end that impatience inside is suffering. And when we look at it that way, I mean, it was just, you know, of course it is. Like when this person said it, I thought, of course it is. But just having it said so clearly, I forget about that. And it is something I actually have control over. It's, you know, the suffering that I add, it's that second arrow to, you know, whatever the conditions are, these are the conditions, and then I have to go, but it shouldn't be that way. Suffering, that's so clear, and I appreciated the person sharing that. So it's just, you know, it's like what Jean said, it was kind of this big reminder, oh, right. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing the second arrow, and I had forgotten it. So just wanted to say again, thank you for Sangha.
Thank you for Sangha. Thank everybody for Sangha for being here today. And just a brief closing of dedication for our practice today, dedicating the merit. So if you just take a moment to be still and listen as I say the words, as I want this for myself, I want it for all beings everywhere. May the benefit of our practice today be shared for the easing of the suffering of all, and may it become a condition of happiness, peace, and final liberation for us and for all beings everywhere. None left out. Thank you, everybody.